Welcome to Changemaker with founder of Gypsy Tea and social entrepreneur Zina Muzika.
This new podcast is to help you embrace change and experience amazing people and entrepreneurs. We're going to be sharing secrets, habits, and change-making abilities with you so that you can apply them to your life and make a life of your dreams.
This is Changemaker with Zina Muzika.
How are you?
I'm great. Full disclosure, we're in a yurt.
Yes, we are.
It's pretty rad.
It's an incredible yurt. I can't believe, like, I'm envious because this is a $9,000 yurt, you're telling me?
It's a $9,000 yurt.
It's a crazy, room.
Well, and I got a lot of bells and whistles for that $9,000. I don't know what they are now, but I bought it from Pacific Yurts. Uh-huh. And I swear, when you Google my name, you see tea and yurts.
Wow.
Because I talk about yurts so much.
Yeah.
Like on Google, they need to sponsor me and give
me
a free yurt.
I love this. This is so cozy.
Yeah.
And it's
something great about a round space.
Yeah.
And I wrote my book in here. And I decided that I couldn't write a book until I had yurt. And so when my contractor put it up, I was like, all right, now I can write my book.
Yeah.
And now I can have a podcast.
There you go.
So welcome to Changemaker.
Thanks for having me.
You're a great changemaker. And if our listeners don't know, this is Zina Muzika. I'm your host. And Pete Farrelly, he is, I don't know if if you're living in a cave, maybe you don't know who he is. But otherwise, he's one half of the Farrelly brothers. And he is famous for Something About Mary, Dumb and Dumber, more recently Dumb and Dumber 2, which is very exciting. Me, myself, and Irene, and another full disclosure, we have the same birthday, December 17th.
That's right.
Yep. So
that's a good sign.
Yeah. So welcome.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks for having me.
I thought we could talk a little bit about the creative process.
I'd love to.
Because, you know, you have been so prolific and you've put out so many brilliant pieces of art and
Thanks.
Humor and writing and directing.
I wish you were a critic.
You know, I some critics just won't ever like humor.
You know, I can we talk about critics for a second?
Let's talk about critics.
Okay, because, you know, in years past, people have always asked, you know, does it bother you that, we do not get good reviews? We never do. And and it used to, I would be lying if I said it didn't bother me at all. I would love to have great reviews. You know,
it hurts. We're human.
It does hurt. And but it was a one day hurt. In the old days where you got the reviews and you thought, oh, shoot, that's not good. And then eventually you learn not to read the reviews, of course. But it went away quickly. And now this is one of the things about the Internet that bugs me is they don't go away. And it's like a review is like your Facebook where, you know, your employers are checking on it in 10 years.
Yeah.
And it's really annoying that it's there all the time. Anybody go on like Rotten Tomatoes? And, oh, wow. I got terrible reviews. Whereas in the past, if the movie did well, the newspapers were gone. They were only there for a day.
Yeah.
And people would just assume they got reasonably good reviews.
It was also, people weren't as influenced by the permanence of negative press. I mean, I marvel at sometimes I'll be watching or reading the Huffington Post or something, and there'll be like, you know, sideline gossip stuff that's just so mean. We're mean to celebrities, and I don't
know
why.
It's not just celebrities. It's the Internet, and, obviously there's phenomenally great things about the Internet, but it is a hateful place.
Sorry.
It really is. I don't mean just for me. I mean for, like, lots of people.
Yeah.
And it is like sports figures, you read, top 10 most hated sports figures. Like, this is a new phenomenon. You know, when I was growing up, you wouldn't like list off people who you hate in sports.
No.
And you wouldn't say, if there was a list, it was top 10 best ways to keep your heart in good shape,
Absolutely.
Or top 10 best ways to, you know, save money and for the future. You know, it was positive. And now it's like, if you go on, if you go online, like every third or fourth thing is a list of negative things, and it's hateful. It's like top 10 least, worst concerts.
Okay, let's talk about our favorite worst reviews, because my book came out 6 months ago, and I have a lot of 5-star reviews, and then I have the reviews of people that just cream me.
Yeah.
And I read one yesterday. I woke up, you know, I wake up at like 4 or 5 in the morning to get my meditation in because I have kids, you know what it's like. And the first thing I decided to check my email, and I got a little notice that I got a new review, and I was like, oh, great. I got a new review. And the woman just was so mean. And I mean, tell me your worst favorite review.
Well, I don't read reviews anymore. I quit reviews probably 10, 15 years ago. Even when I get good reviews, I don't read the good ones, because then I feel creepy that I'm only reading the good ones and not the bad ones. Then I'm a psycho. You know, I don't do that. Like, I have my sister say, you got to read the New York Times. A great review. I'm sorry, honey, I'm not going to read that because I'm not reading the bad ones. I don't want to just read the good ones.
Well, we all read them for you, and we're rooting you on.
Well, thank you.
Because you happen to be one of the nicest guys I know.
Well, that's sweet. And but my favorite bad review was a Rex Reed review for Something About Mary. And we actually framed it and put it on the wall of our office. And it was there for a long time because it was, there's never been a worse review of anything. It's just like.
And Something About Mary was probably one of my all-time favorite movies.
Well, like, thanks. But that, again, did not get all great reviews. It got a lot of good reviews, but it got, you know, some scathing reviews. And this one was, it said, I think the opening word was sewage. And it says, it's pure sewage. From, you know, two of the sleaziest, scummiest people on the planet, the Farrelly brothers. And it went from
so
there.
It was a personal attack.
So they get very personal. They always do. I mean, many times. They don't
crazy.
Always, but often it gets like, you know, like that. But it was so horrible that we were giggling. Even before the movie came out, I was laughing about it. Even I didn't even know we had a hit yet. And I was like, look at this review. This is unbelievable. And, of course, there's some, I just don't read them because, it doesn't feel good.
No. So, Dumb and Dumber 2, though, is doing pretty well.
Did great. It's doing 150 already worldwide, and it's killing.
It's great. Yeah. And, you know, we talked one time. Well, let's talk a little bit about this first, then we'll go into the creative process.
Yeah.
But one time we were talking about how you bring out the best in your actors and the people on set. And
well, I try to. I don't know that I do, but
well,
it's an effort.
It was impressive to me in a business standpoint because the way you were explaining it, I think a lot of managers could really learn from. And it was how you build them up, and you're always looking for the gold inside them, so that you're always bringing that out and allowing them to shine more instead of criticizing them, belittling them. So you want to just talk a little bit about your secrets?
Well, I feel that the hardest job on a movie is the actor. They have the toughest job. They're putting it out there. They're laying it on the line, and they're the most vulnerable.
Yeah.
They're the face. And to begin with, actors who are artists are sensitive souls, mostly, not all. Some are tough, but most of them are very sensitive people. I mean, like even guys you wouldn't expect, like a Bill Murray's got, he's just a little kid inside, you know, I've sat down with Bill and had discussions where, you know, Bill Murray, you think, you know, solid as a rock. Well, there's a little boy in there that gets hurt and gets, you know, has a life and has a lot going on. And he's trying to grow as a human and make the world a better place and make his family better. And he's got his own struggles. So everybody is like that. But I think artists are a little more so. And so I go into it knowing that these guys are vulnerable people and they're laying it on the line. And my goal is to make them as comfortable as they can be in their working environment so that they're willing to take chances because they're coming in vulnerable. Mm-hmm. And then if they start feeling stress of any kind on that set, like, tension with the director or any other crew member and stuff like that. I think that maybe not consciously, but subconsciously or unconsciously, they stop taking chances because they're afraid of failure.
Yeah.
And they don't want to fail in front of people that they have not a good feeling around.
Yeah.
If you're around your friends, you'll do the stupidest things in the world because you don't give a shit. They're your friends.
Yeah.
They love you. You know they love you.
Yeah.
And anybody could be goofy and it's all forgiven. And that's what I want them to feel. I want them to have that opportunity to fail because acting is not always successful. It's like you try something. No, not quite right. Try it this way.
Yeah.
No, not quite right. Try it again.
Yeah.
Bingo. That's the thing. Yeah. And they must, like the great actors, the Jim Carreys, the Bill Murrays, these guys, they have to have the balls to try things that other people wouldn't try. And that's why, like, I always talk about, like, Ace Ventura. Like, when I saw Ace Ventura, I just remember thinking, oh, this is like the bravest actor ever.
Totally.
Because that movie was either going to be a smashing hit or a huge disaster. That choice was monstrous.
Yeah.
It was a crazy choice. And yet it worked because
courage.
He went out there. And I try to do that. And sometimes actors, they get tense and stressed because they're under pressure and they will occasionally snap or, lash out a little. And my thing is like, and I do this, and when I get up in the morning, I say a prayer every morning when I'm making a movie and I say, please just give me patience and, kindness and let me lead with love.
Definitely.
And because a lot of times someone snaps at you, you want to snap back like, fuck you. What the fuck? I hope this is okay on this.
They'll bleep it out.
Okay. And I'm like, what are you, but you don't. What you do is you take a breath and you realize, okay, this guy's under pressure.
Yeah.
And then you talk to him and you find out what's wrong and you calm him down and you get him and you get him back on track. I don't have an ego on a set. I really do not. I don't
want to, right?
I don't want to win.
Yeah.
I want the actor to win. I want the actor wins, the movie wins.
Absolutely.
And I've had once or twice. And by the way, my actors, they don't snap much. I mean, maybe one every three movies, somebody will just kind of lash out. Nothing bad.
Don't you have like an emergency bottle of something somewhere?
I actually do. Well, this is what happened. One time I had an actor, and this is rare, very rare. It's not like on every movie, but one time I had an actor and he was having a hard time with a scene. And the other actors in the scene weren't having a hard time, which was more pressure for him because he felt like he was messing up the scene. We kept doing it over and over and over. Well, as it turned out, I had actually liked what he did early in that in the scene, the early takes. And then he was unsatisfied. And so we always go on. I want him to be satisfied. But we kept going, kept going, kept going. And he couldn't satisfy himself. And finally, I came over. I said, look, I liked it 10 takes ago. I like where you were. And he goes, well, I don't like it. God damn it. He started snapping at me. And I said, okay, let's take a break. Come into my trailer. And we went in there and I said, look, man, we're having a ball. This is like a great shoot. This is a great movie. It's been an honor working with you. And let's not go there. Let's, I'm sorry if I stressed you out, but I don't mean to. And I poured us each. I always keep a bottle of vodka in my freezer in my trailer. We did one shot each, toasted, and went back to work. And that was it. And by the way, I've only used that bottle of vodka twice in my career. I always have it there, but twice I've had to take a guy in. Come on, let's do this. And but by the way, when I got
pretty
back to the
stats.
Set, or the next day, or at some point, because when he was snapping at me, he's mic'd. Well, a lot of my crew members are listening to this, and he lashed out, and I had a guy come up to me and said, I don't understand how you could take that from him. You got to get him in his place. I said, no, I don't. I said, I'm not here to win. I'm here for him to be as comfortable as he can be and make the best movie we can make. That's what it's about. This isn't my child who I have to make a better person. That's not my job, actually, here. My job is to get a great performance out of him, and I have to get him in the right frame of mind to do that.
I hope all the entrepreneurs are listening to this and taking lots of notes, because this is really it's a great management thing. The first time you told me how you go about it, I just thought, God, if every young CEO could, take a class from you on how to manage an actor, they would know how to manage, you know, their top salesperson or, you know, anybody who right. has, you know, high pressure on themselves. Because normally people are harder on themselves than we could ever be.
Right.
So, you know, if we're the good guy in the game, it'd be great. So let's
I'll tell you something else that does is when you and this is a lot of directors, they go in. The director is the top dog on the set, mm-hmm. and they go in thinking if nobody can do say anything wrong to them or bad, and if they do, they're going to take them out. Well, no, that's not what the top dog does. Mm-hmm. The top dog sets a tone, mm-hmm. and that tone will flow all the way down. As long as you keep your cool, mm-hmm. everyone's going to keep their cool. And if you snap at that guy below you, he's going to snap at the one below him, and she's going to snap, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
And then you got people snapping at everyone, and you have a very unhealthy, unhappy bunch of people.
Well, and higher budgets and more.
Everything goes well.
Yeah,
It's just not what you do.
You're listening to Changemaker with Zena Muzyka. Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it. This is Changemaker with Zena Muzyka.
Okay, so we've talked about your magic on the set and, you know, how you bring out the best in others. Let's talk a little bit about your creative process, because you have consistently written since college or even before.
Not really. I started actually writing after college.
Okay. Well, you decided to quit your job.
Yeah.
Became a waiter.
Yes.
Did the traditional, you know, starving artist thing.
Exactly.
And you were inspired to start a master's program.
Yeah, I went to UMass Amherst for creative writing. By the way, I'm sorry if I sound all stuffed up, because
okay.
I am.
That's all right. Tis the season.
But and then I went to get my master's in creative writing at UMass Amherst, and then while I was there, I ended up transferring to Columbia, and I finished at Columbia, and then I sold a screenplay, came out, and boom.
Okay, so you sold a screenplay right after school?
Actually, during school. Yes.
Impressive.
Well, it was a lot of luck too. I mean, it was you know, I got together with a friend. I wasn't in a film program. I was in a creative writing program. I was writing a
book.
That's
what I went to school for. Yeah.
Where'd you go?
I went to an all women's college in the Midwest, but I dropped out.
Where?
Cotty College.
Is that Ohio?
No, Nevada, Missouri, in the middle of nowhere.
Wow.
Yeah. But
and you majored in creative writing?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And then I ended up going to Peru with a group of ethnobotanists, studied with a bunch of shamans, and uh-huh. that was how I got my tea start. But I've written since I was a little kid. It's
wow.
been my dream from day one. So, yeah,
that's
now
great.
That
See,
I'm a publisher,
yeah.
it's really exciting, because not only do I get to write, but I get to help other people.
Yeah.
You know, really, I'm kind of in that role of director with my authors now.
Right, of course.
Where I'm bringing out the best in them, and it's such a tender, incredible responsibility to have.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, it's really exciting.
I can't believe how lucky you are to be in that position where you can, you know,
I pinch
nurture
myself
writers
day.
And in the best way possible.
Well, and, you know, I grew up in a family where my dad said, you know, writers don't make money. You better get a day job. And then as soon as I published my book, you know, my dad was watching me on Lou Dobbs and watching me, you know, he watches my Amazon ticker every day. He checks it like 6 times a day. He keeps a handwritten tally.
Oh, really?
Of what my ranking is.
Wow.
He compares it to other similar books.
Yeah.
And then every time I see him, which is about once a month, he gives me this big handwritten tally of my you know, how I'm doing. And
fantastic.
And not too long ago, he said, well, you know, writers make good money, so you should just really focus on that. And
really?
I thought, what?
Where'd that come from?
Exactly. But, you know, we have a similar passion in that. And so tell me about your creative process. You tend to work with other writers
I do.
And collaborate.
I write, you know, alone when I work on a book, or I do some short story stuff like that. And I enjoy that a lot. But screenwriting, I find it way more useful to write with other people. And usually it's my brother or Bennett Yellen or Pete Jones or Mike Cerrone. There's a group. And there are guys who, like, we spark to each other. Like, if I have a little idea, they'll make it bigger, and then I can take it from there. And we have a very nice working relationship. And we also understand it's like a band.
Yeah.
Like, everybody has their role in the band. And, you know, we got a guy who's on the keyboards, you know, he's working away at the computer. And we got the guy who's, like, is just sitting in the background giving us the bass, and he's throwing in little jokes here and there. What about this? What about that? And I actually... I kind of would say I'm like the lead guitarist, where I'm walking through the room and I'm just sort of like thinking. And then those guys are, I have like, I'm throwing out crap and they're kind of refining it and making it better as I throw it out. And then my brother, I would say, would be like, you know, he's like the songwriter, other guitarist, and he's like coming up with licks and leading stuff. It's really interesting how it works, but we all get along, and it's a fun way to do it. I really enjoy that. But the way we do it is different than when I went to grad school at Columbia. For 1 week, we had John Irving come in. He taught what was called a master's class.
Yeah.
And he taught us every day. It was like a 3 or 4 hour class. And everybody could, you know, sit in, and he just told us how he did it. And I remember he said something that the exact opposite of the way I work. And he said, he writes long novels. They're 900 pages. Yeah. And he says he really works the novel out before he begins writing it. And he will not begin writing that book until he knows the last sentence.
Ugh. Incredible.
He has to know exactly where he's going. Well, we don't do that.
Yeah.
I do it quite opposite. I work out the first act. I got to know who the people are, what the problem is, what they're going to set out to do, what the issues are. And we'll take a long time working that out. Like, make sure we have characters that we like enough that we're going to follow through this. But then we write blind and we let it go where the story goes. And it's a kind of a, like... You know, it's a hard way to write, and it's an easy way to write. The easy way is because you're just letting it go and getting it, letting the story flow where it wants to flow. And obviously, you're throwing things out there and trying to work in a different way. But if somebody has an idea, somebody says like, "Hey, well, what if they stopped at that gas station and there was a holdup at the gas station?" Well, if you've got that whole thing mapped up, you can't have that.
Yeah.
You say, well,
you can't have the spontaneity.
We can't, because if that happens,
I find that with your movies. I mean, you don't know what's going to happen,
well,
which is
hope.
What makes them so great. I mean, there's nothing formulaic, really. I mean, you have the typical elements that you have to have, but they're not very formulaic. It's like, oh my God, I can't believe you just did that.
Yeah.
It's fabulous.
Well, you know, when we were, this, and I've told this story before, but it's a great example of how we do it and when we're doing it best. It's Something About Mary. We get to about page 40. Now, Something About Mary was a script written by Ed Dechter and John Strauss 10 years earlier. They're buddies of ours. And it just went into development hell. And Bobby and I always loved that idea. So we said, can we take a crack at getting it over the hump? So we started rewriting it. And we got to page 45. And then we froze up because we realized, well, wait a second. Mary's going to end up with Ted. We know that. Everybody knows that. It's so obvious. It's like depressing. I mean, there's only one thing that could happen. She's going to end up with Ted. The audience knows that. We know that. And we froze for about 2 weeks. And during that period, I happened to watch Bottle Rocket on video, which was Wes Anderson and Owen Wilson and Luke Wilson's first movie. And someone told me about it. I was watching it. And the great thing about that is that movie just went where it wanted to go. It starts off, they break out, you know, Owen out of an insane asylum, kind of. And then he has a 5-year plan. We're going to rob mom and pops. We're going to do this. We're going to hit banks. We're going to be set for life. They've set out the first night. They stop at a motel. And Luke Wilson falls in love with the chambermaid and doesn't want to leave. And they just let it go there. Well, I know... And I haven't discussed this with them, but I know that they didn't set out to write a thing like that where a guy falls in love with a chambermaid.
Yeah.
They started writing a story, and when they had the chambermaid come into the story and it started developing, they let it go that way.
Yeah.
They didn't fight it.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking, Mary doesn't have to end up with Ted.
Totally.
That's our mistake.
Let's liberate her.
She doesn't have to. We're writing it wrong.
Yeah.
And I had my brother watch. I said, Bob, we got to write this from now on. She could end up with anybody. And that's how we wrote from that point forward. And so each of the characters that came in, the Matt Dillon character, or, you know, Chris Elliott, all these people, we wrote it fairly, you know, like any of them could. We didn't know who she was going to end up with. We wrote it not knowing who was going to get her. And it wasn't, it was only at the end when Brett Favre came in and we realized he would be the perfect one for her to end up with that we thought, well, wait a second. Now we could switch it. Let's give her to Ted because the audience believes that she's ending up with Brett Favre.
Yeah.
And now and we had the possibility to do it, but we couldn't plan it that way. We had to write it in an honest kind of way.
I write the same way. I write to discover, and that it was hard for me to write Life by the Cup in the sense that I knew what was going to happen because it was a memoir. And for me, I would write these 10,000, 15,000 word chapters, and then have to give them to my story editor, and she would have to cut 90% of it out because I just wanted to cruise. Yeah. I wanted to find out what was in there. And I was surprised at what I ended up finding in my own life that I hadn't seen before. So I love the idea of the discovery because that's what makes the creative writing process so much fun.
Absolutely. And also, I mean, that's any writing. Most writers, I can't say any because I don't know that, but most writers I know, you throw out as many pages as you keep. And like, you know, almost always, by the time we get to page 45 of a screenplay, we cut back, we'll cut out half of that.
Yeah.
And we'll have some gems in there. We'll have some really good, we'll have crap. We'll have shit. Like, I'd rather write five shitty pages than no pages.
Exactly.
Because, you know, five shitty pages, you could find something good in that.
Absolutely.
And you could turn it into something good. If you've got nothing, you got nothing. If you got 10 shitty pages, you might make two good pages.
Well, let's talk about that for a second. Do you keep a journal, or do you actually keep the writing happening when you're not working on a project?
I keep a lot of notes. Like, good. If I... think of something or observe something, or a friend says something funny, or I'm always jotting down notes, and then later when I am writing, after we've established who the characters are, I'll flip through my notebooks. I probably have 20-30 notebooks, and I'll go through them, and I'll spend an afternoon just flipping through and see if there's any lines in there that would fit this character. And if there are, then it's funny what one line will do. It'll spark a scene, you know?
Yeah.
It's
a catalyst.
Yeah, it's great, and I'll do it all the time, especially when we're a little stumped.
Yeah.
I'll just flip through, and I'll say, hey, guys, what about this line? What do you think of this? And then it'll spark. It happens a lot that way, where somebody says one line.
Yeah.
And we say, that would be a great line for whatchamacallit. And then when you think of that line, that opens up a whole scene.
It's great. It's great. I mean, you have to have such a level of trust to be in the creative process the way you are on an ongoing basis. And I think for our listeners, it's good for them to know that, you know, you're throwing a ton of it out. You're constantly moving and improving. You're always, you know, you're collaborating. All the things that people are scared to do with their creative process. It's almost like, oh, I don't want to sound stupid. Yeah. Or, you know, I talk with a lot of first-time authors who are, you know, nervous about how they'll come across. And you have to get over that.
Yeah.
You cannot be...
Well, I always describe writer's block as the fear of writing crappy pages. Because when you have writer's block where you can't write, you could always write crap.
Absolutely.
And if you write crap, something good will come out of it. Like, just get something down.
Yeah.
And people, like, there was a guy, you know, like one of the best writers I went to grad school with. He only wrote like two short stories in 2 years, and he was probably the best writer in the program, but the guy could not bear to show something that wasn't perfect.
Yeah.
And it really handcuffed him, whereas I would write 45, 50 pages of crap and end up with like an 8-page something.
Yeah.
And that was reasonable.
Yeah.
And from reasonable, you can get good, and from good, very good, and then excellent, and so on. And I just wrote, just keep writing. Like, I'm not afraid to put down crap because I, you know, when people pick up a book, and I've had people do this a lot, like, wow, I don't know how you ever write a novel. It's crazy. I was like, well, you can't do it when you think about writing a novel.
No.
You have to think about writing two pages.
Well, and I have to think about who I'm writing for.
Yeah.
I especially with nonfiction, which is my only, I'm playing in fiction right now, but with nonfiction, as soon as I know I'm serving someone else. Uh-huh. Like I can envision a woman in my head who needs, you know, a boost of confidence or inspiration, and I'm going to write to her.
Yeah.
Then it's almost like I'm writing a love letter, and then it just flows. Yeah. And it's very helpful.
I think of it as a letter a lot too.
Yeah.
Like, I describe it that way to people. Like guys have said, I could never write a, you know, book. I said, well, could you write a letter? They said, oh yeah. I said, like, how long? And like, 2-3 pages. I said, right. So if you wrote a 2-3 page letter, you would generally write a letter in one day, right? You know, you write a letter. Well, if you did that for 5 days in a row, you have 15 pages in a week.
Yeah.
And then if you did that for 10 weeks in a row, you have 150 pages, and that's less than a season, and you almost have a book.
Yeah.
And that's how it goes. That's how you have to think of it. You have to just focus on a couple pages here and there, and it just builds up.
Definitely. Yeah. I've kept a journal since I could spell.
Uh-huh.
And I've lugged them around everywhere I've lived. So they were in Peru with me, and Idaho, and Kansas, and Missouri, and California. I mean, everywhere I went, they went with me. And when Leverage, those guys optioned my book, you know, these silly journals that I've kept my whole life, I just dropped them off at their office, you know, to develop the, like, here's 10 years of my life. You know, you need character development. Here, read it.
And somebody just took it and went through it.
Yeah, they're going through it now. Yeah. So it's, and for me, people are like, oh my God, aren't you nervous about what they're going to read? And I'm like, yeah, I was completely, you know, stupid. I was in my 20s. I was naive. I didn't know what I was doing. I was divorced by 21. I made every mistake in the world. Like, give it to them because it's going to help somebody, right?
But also, that's what writing is. It's telling the truth.
It's
If there's no truth in it, it's like when you see a piece of art, like a painting, like it, and it strikes something in you, like, well, that's... there's something truth in that. There's something that's real that is hitting you as like, oh, I know that thing. And when you read good fiction or any good writing, it's when there's a reality, a truth in it, and you say, that's great. Like, I remember one time I was writing with a guy, and we put something down, and he said, I don't know about that. He goes, you know, my grandmother's going to see this movie. And I said, really? You think of that? So you can't think of that. Have you thought, like, do you know?
I did that in the beginning.
Portnoy's
My son's going to read this book.
Would have never been written if he was thinking about his grandmother. You know, Catcher in the Rye, that would never have been written.
Absolutely.
You know, you can't write thinking of family members at all. You have to be honest with yourself, and that's the only way you're going to get some truth out of it. If you start changing it you know,
it's true. It's
not
true. Then
be
you're
real.
Then you're writing to an expectation somebody may or may not have.
Yeah.
So it's like building a house on a cloud. So I love it.
You're listening to Changemaker with Zena Musica. Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it. This is Changemaker with Zena Musica.
So I have some other questions. I mean,
we've
done really well, and right. I've only gotten through two.
That's all right. You're easy to talk to.
Oh, well, you know, Sagittarians, look at us.
Yeah.
You answered a bunch of these. Oh, one of them was, do you still road trip? So tell us a little bit about that, because I love it.
Well, you know... I do road trip. I like to hit the road. I've driven cross country 21 times, 16 alone, which I prefer. You know, it's nice to go with someone, but you don't get the things accomplished that I try to do on a road trip. And that's this. When I get a little confused in my life, or, you know, with personal things or work things or whatever it is, I feel like, what's the next move? I don't know what to do. I'm confused. You know, your brain's cluttered. Mm-hmm. I hop in the car and I go, and it's, I guess, when I read about transcendental meditation, mm-hmm. I get kind of a similar thing out of that, which is basically clarity. And the way I do it is this: I hit the road, and every time I do it, the first day I'm like, what are you doing? Why did you do this? This is horrible. You're just looking at the road.
And that bed's not even half as comfortable as my bed at home.
And you're just buzzing along like, well, I have like 5 days of this. And it's like, I don't know where I'm staying tonight. You know, And then, but that first day, I start going through my head, and I have a list of a little pad next to me on the seat, and I think, what are the things that are bugging me lately? And I make a list. I like, you know, I haven't talked to my college roommate, and, you know, my buddy so-and-so had, like, a heart problem, and I haven't really talked to him since after that happened. And did I ever thank so-and-so for that thing they did for me? And and what about this? And blah, 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 blah. And, you know, this guy's a really good guy, and I haven't talked to him in a while. All the things. And I make a list of all the things. Call my, you know, mother. Do this. Do that. Spend more time with this person. Do this. Do that. And basically, I empty my brain. And that's a day or two where I all the little crap that is just in my brain that I – that are bugging me that you just kind of keep putting off. I put into a list, and I know when I get to my destination, I will accomplish all those things, and I always do. When I get there, I make those phone calls, I reach out to those people, I do those thank you notes, I do whatever I have to do. Well, after that, you know, after day two, your brain is empty of all the clutter, the little clutter, and that does something where for me, where at some point I get clarity. And I get into the bigger things. And, you know, they say, of course, you know, that the wisest voice, you have many voices in your head, and the wisest voice is the quietest voice. Yeah. And when you get rid of all those other voices that are, hey, don't forget to do that. Hey, what are you doing? Hey, did you call your sister? Blah, 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 blah. Then you have this wiser voice in you. And it's just telling you, like, whatever your issue is, you know, just do this. And by the way, every time it happens, and I always tell this, it's like, it's the simplest solution. It's so simple. It's not like, oh my God, that's genius. What a great idea. It's so easy and simple. You're like, just do this. You're like, oh yeah.
Really?
And, but you couldn't see that for all the clutter in the way.
Of course.
And in fact, you end up, like, I end up getting like days, like 2 days, or if I'm lucky, I'll get 2-3 days at the end of the drive. But usually, two's good. Sometimes only one. And I will get just clarity where I can see everything I should be doing in my life the correct way. It's very clear to me. Yeah. And it feels pure. I feel good. I write these things down. I know what to do. My brain's emptied of all the junk. And I know where to go from there. And in fact, one time, and I told this story once before, but I was driving cross country, and I went from Boston to LA, and I got all the way to Arizona. I had not had a breakthrough. Like, I really was not having any sort of clarity, and it was disturbing. And I'm like 4 or 5 days in driving, and I was just like, I don't know whether I had the radio on too much, because I turned that off a lot, or I don't know what it was, but it didn't come. And then it came. It came after Phoenix, which is pretty close to LA. That's like 6 hours from LA. And I just had clarity, and boom, boom, boom. I started writing stuff down, things to do. Ideas for stories, how to make the story better, character things, all the stuff that, oh, this is a mistake, that's good, this is better. And I got home to Santa Monica, and it was like probably 10 o'clock at night, and I was just on a roll, and I didn't want it to end because it's so hard to get into that part of your brain where you have this clarity. So I drove all the way to San Francisco. I didn't stop. I went up to PCH, kept going all the way to San Francisco, turned around, came back. I got home 10 in the morning to Santa Monica, and by then I'm just drained and it's over. And but I got so much work done, I couldn't shut. I didn't want the brain, because it would take a year to get that thing open again, like it was. And anyway, that's what I do for inspiration and for clarity and for general good mental health.
Absolutely, it's. I love it because I'm a freedom seeker too, and I love people, and I love new roads to travel. And traveling for me is always the thing that breaks me out of a funk.
Yeah.
Always. I mean, just being 30,000 feet high, and for me, when I was writing Life by the Cup, when I was finishing it, I got on the train from Ventura to San Diego and back and forth until I was done, because something about the train for me with that rhythm, and you don't have to think, you know, you're just sitting there. I love it. I'm with you on that.
And I also get in a very, like, I got to say, when I get into that place, it's a very loving place. You know, there's in your center, there's a lot of love in your center, which is being blocked out by crap in your life. And when you get into that place and you do feel centered, I'm like, I'm just in love with humanity. I'm telling you, like, I stop at a gas station and I just strike up a conversation with the trucker or the woman behind the counter or the woman who gives me a sandwich, and I'm just feeling so much love for every one of these people. It's like, and they can feel it because they're like coming at me with smiles. They're like, oh wow, this guy's a
emanating it.
I'm totally emanating it, and they're coming at me, and I'm just looking for, and I'm thinking, what is it? Like, I see so many beautiful things about each one of them, and it's not hard.
Yeah.
And I'm like, dude, that's an awesome hat. Where do you get that? He goes, oh, I got this from my grandson. That's awesome. Great. Oh, thank you, man.
Yeah.
You see a woman, and she's behind a counter at a 7-Eleven, and you're like, you got... Those are like the nicest eyes I have seen in weeks. They're fantastic eyes, really? I see, they're beautiful. Thank you. You know, you see beauty in people... that you don't normally see when you get centered.
Because you're
like
taking
that.
Care of yourself.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we're both parents. We both have kids. And I mean, Gerard has been working for 7 years on his writing project, which he finished. Thank God. But it was like every weekend, you know, I was taking care of the kids and we were going back and forth. And, you know, at a certain point, you can't see the forest for the, in my book, I call it, I couldn't see the forest for the trees. But it's like you can't actually get perspective on how brilliant and beautiful everything is because you're tired.
Right.
And, you know, all the little details of life come at you. It's like me working at home. You know, I'm always seeing how many dishes need to be done. And sometimes I just need to go work in a hotel 20 minutes away just to get my work done and clear out my mind. So I'm with you on that. I think it's a really important thing for people to hear about, you know, because I think so many people feel selfish for caring for themselves.
Well, yeah. And my wife is great. I have a fantastic wife. I'm lucky. And
Very lucky. She
when I get cluttered, she knows it, and she'll just tell me, she says, you should take a drive. I'm like, really? She goes, yeah, just go. I said, well, what about the thing we have? Just go. And I'm like, all right. So I'll get in the car, and I remember one time this was like an hour's notice. I was in my office, and we were talking on the phone, and I was trying to figure something out. It was work-related. And she said, why don't you just get in the car and drive somewhere? I was like, well, I don't have time to go cross country. She goes, just go to somewhere else. So I drove to Canada from LA. I went straight north and I went all the way up to Vancouver. I cut over to Sandpoint, Idaho, and then I drove back.
I was born up there.
So really?
Oh, yeah. I love it up there.
It's gorgeous.
It's so gorgeous.
Fantastic. But I just got in the car in a 1 hour notice. I just called I didn't drive back. That's right. I called a car rental place. And I picked up a car a half hour later, and I drove it up to Vancouver. Then I drove over to Sandpoint. Then I drove back to Seattle, and I flew home. And it took, you know, it was like probably 2 days, the whole trip, you know.
I love it. I love it. So permission to set yourself free, really.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah, it's helpful for me. It is. But, you know, I guess that is what meditation is. And, in fact, I just started doing meditation. We have a friend who teaches TM.
Doing TM.
Well, yeah, I just started like a couple weeks ago. And he just, you know, I'll be honest, I'm not quite,
none of us are good at it.
Getting it yet.
I've been meditating for 14 years and I still don't get it. I just sit like writing every day. I have to sit my butt down every day at the same time and just do it. And some days I feel like superpower meditation goddess. And some days I feel like piece of crap meditation loser.
It's weird. I haven't gotten like any kind of a remotely, like, I haven't gotten clarity doing it yet. I really haven't, like, where I've like come out of it thinking, oh, you know. But on the other hand, there's part of me that it's a 20-minute thing twice a day, exactly. Although I could be honest, I probably do it once a day.
Yeah.
But there's a part of me that's like kind of craves it every day now. And I'm thinking, take those 20 minutes, do it. But it almost feels just like a 20-minute nap for me.
Yeah.
But I'm going to do it for a couple more months and see if, you know, see what happens. It's more of a test. I've only done it for like 3 weeks.
What I find with meditation is it creates spaciousness in my brain on an ongoing basis where I can't jump in a car or I can't fly to Bali or I can't do some of those things where it's, for me, it's maintenance. And it also helps me reflect on what I feel I'm doing right and wrong in my life. Like, because I get very action oriented and where I'm going, and I don't stop to look and say, how am I affecting others? Am I really paying attention to my health? it's really the time where I take a look at things.
Yeah.
And
but I thought, like, you know, and
I do Vipassana. So I do, it's an insight meditation.
So you're not really, like, my thing is you're supposed to just be saying your mantra and not thinking of anything.
Yeah, I do Vipassana where I focus on the breath, and then I actually teach it in the book. So you have a copy of the book now. But I focus on the breath, and then I scan the body for sensations. And as they arise, you name them and move on, name them and move on. Yeah. And it's actually how Buddha became enlightened.
Yeah.
And it starts out with a 10-day silent sit.
Yeah.
And I've been craving doing another one of those. But ever since Mia was born, it's like, oh, my God, to be away from her for 10 days is impossible. But it's a very powerful practice. And I also do japa sometimes where I just chant.
Well,
that I can't get
your it. Style of meditation sounds more like my trips cross country.
Yes.
I'm going through my head. I'm just
naming
going,
it.
I have 5 days alone. And I'm just going right down the list, knocking things, off, writing them down. And then after, again, 2, 3, 4 days sometimes, finding the center where I feel, oh, yeah, right.
Well, it's naming it and not reacting to it.
Yeah.
So we tend to run toward pleasure and away from pain. So we're constantly in transit.
Yeah.
And when we're, like, for us, we're saying, oh, well, we're not very good meditators. Well, we're running toward being a great meditator to get that high that meditation can bring, or that clarity, because we're addicted to that.
Yeah.
But with Vipassana, you're actually just naming the stuff as it rises, letting it go, naming it, letting it go, so that you're no longer running at something.
Yeah.
And for me, it's extremely liberating.
Yeah.
And it helps me to know my mind, because the whole point is to learn your mind, have compassion for yourself.
Right.
And that is, I think, nirvana in a way.
Wow.
So, well, this went way better than I thought. We were going to talk about humor, but I think this is more important. And, you know, let's talk a little bit. You know, we're 45 minutes in.
Okay.
And you're just so awesome. I could talk to you forever.
Oh,
and, you know, tell me a little bit about what, so you just came out with Dumb and Dumber 2.
Yeah.
It took 20 years to come up with the sequel. So much
well,
fun.
Well, it wasn't, I mean, literally.
Well, it didn't take 20 years to come up with it. But
yeah, we're always working on something, and it was it was something that we never had done a sequel. It was the only one we would consider doing a sequel of. You know, there was talk about doing a sequel to Something About Mary, but that felt like a money grab. Like, the story
inauthentic.
Ended. And then, but we always thought if you were going to do a sequel, it'd be Dumb and Dumber because they don't grow. There's no growth. They're exactly the same with beginning and end. And so you could just take it from there. And it, and also I love those characters, and I love Jim, and I love Jeff, you know, Jim Carrey, Jeff Daniels, and it would be fun to do. So, we really didn't start talking about it until about 5 years ago. And, Jim called me. He had been in a hotel. He watched Dumb and Dumber, happened to be on TV. He watched it, and he called me after. He said, "We got to do this another Dumb and Dumber. It's too much fun." So anyway, yes, we did it. It was fun.
Well, I'm really glad it's doing well.
Thanks.
And I feel like, you know, your brand of humor is so ornery and dorky and fabulous. And you let yourself, you know, just be a kid, which I think is just so fantastic. And I think the critics really perhaps need to just lighten up a little bit and, let humor be humor. But
I mean, you know, in fairness, you know, we've gotten our share of good reviews over the years too. But it's just that there's so many more venues. You know, it used to be L.A. Times, New York Times, you know, USA Today, and that's
and
what you cared
about. Now you've got BuzzFeed.
Oh my God, there's zillions of them,
TMZ,
and they're all trying to get their own. You know, they're all like kind of like smart alecky.
Yeah,
and,
the more sardonic, the more likes they'll get.
Yeah, just think of a, you know, whatever. But
well, let's talk a little bit about, you know, plans for 2015. Do you have a New Year's resolution? Are you, I mean, I know you do a cleanse every, is it September and January?
I do twice a year. I do a 1 month. It's not really, I mean, yeah, I guess it's a cleanse of sorts. It's I take a month off, usually at the end of summer, September, and then sometimes January or February, depending on my schedule, where I will quit, you know, alcohol for a month, and I'll quit, you know, pasta and
sugar
and dairy. You know, all the stuff that, you know, just
clogs us up
for 1 month. And it started with just an alcohol thing where, you know, at the end of the summer, like, people be handing you drinks at parties, and I'm like, I feel nothing.
Yeah.
I'm like, you know, I'm numb from it. And also at the end of December, after all the holiday parties.
Totally.
So I just want a month off for it, because the truth of the matter is I like to drink. And if you take a month off and you have a drink, it's a nice little feeling, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
And like my buddy Rich Brown has a great bit about this. He's a comedian. And he says he quits drinking a month a year. He takes a month off every year. He says, because if you can't take a month off from drinking a year, then that means something's you're an up. Alcoholic. And if you're an alcoholic, then you can't drink at all. And I love to drink. And that's kind of it. It's just sort of a, you know, testing the brakes.
Yeah.
Twice a year. But also, you know, it's just sort of, you know, a little, yeah, it's a little cleansing thing.
Yeah, it's a balance too.
Yeah.
You're listening to Changemaker with Zena Musica. Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it. This is Changemaker with Zena Musica.
And so 2015, what are your plans?
Well, I have a thing that we're doing at Amazon called Louder Milk, which is a TV show that we're just getting going with right now.
How cool. You're doing Amazon Original?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm in love with Transparent.
Yeah. I actually haven't seen it, but I hear great things about it.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm getting chills just talking about it. And I have a friend that I went to college with who's transitioning right now, Molly, and she's Henry now. And just how beautiful and scary the process is.
Mm-hmm.
And man, they just nail so much in that.
Really?
It's such a compassionate and beautiful view, and it's so tender.
Yeah.
And
also, who hasn't had a parent have a sex change, you know? I mean, you know, it just hits home for everyone. It's so universal.
Yeah, exactly. Or your parent is somewhat alien to you in some way, so you're trying to figure them out, and they're trying to figure you out anyway. So it does, you know, there is a lot to relate to, actually, in it. So,
We're also doing a thing called Ricky Stenicki, which is a movie, and it's really fun. This is a really fun one. It's about these kids who invent a fictional character, Ricky Stenicki. Whenever they get in trouble, they blame it on Ricky Stenicki. Like, they break a window. Who broke the window? Ricky Stenicki broke it. Well, stay away from Stenicki, you know, and they're teenagers now, and they get caught drinking, and the parents, where'd you get the booze? Ricky Stenicki bought it, you know, and they're like, I don't want you hanging around Stenicki.
Does he show up?
Well, now they're adults, and they're still using Ricky Stenicki. They're married. They have, you know, kids, girlfriends, whatever. And they're telling the wives, honey, Stenicki's having a fundraiser in New Orleans. We got to go for the hurricane people. And they go to Vegas, and this guys have been using – he's their lie. And something happens where the wives get very suspicious, and they say, we want to meet Stenicki. And they're like, well, no, Stenicki's always in Africa working with the, you know.
He's a philanthropist,
of course.
I don't care.
He didn't go to anybody's wedding. He didn't do this. We want to meet Stenicki. And so they have to hire an actor to be Ricky Stenicki and come visit them. And they have a Bible that they've kept.
I was going to say, they have got.
Every time they lie, they write it down over the years. So they just give this actor the Bible, and he studies who Ricky Stenicki is. And this guy comes to visit him, and basically a lie comes to life. And unfortunately, the wives and Stenicki hit it off hugely. And Stenicki doesn't have much of a life in Vegas, so he thinks, I'm going to live here. And now
I'm going to become.
Yeah, he's going to move there and become Ricky Stenicki. And they are, these guys are now trying to get rid of Ricky Stenicki. It's a really fun thing because I love
that
whole idea
great.
Of what would happen if your biggest lie came to life, and what are the repercussions? And it's a lot of, you know, it's funny, but it's also, it's a real lesson in it.
I love it.
Yeah,
so is it coming out next
year?
Well,
we haven't shot it yet. We're right now, Jim Carrey plays Ricky Stenicki.
Oh, he's perfect.
And we're still, you know, casting.
That's great. And do you have a studio or what's, is it?
Yeah, it's Lionsgate.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, fantastic. Mm-hmm. It sounds like a great.
Yeah, it's going to be fun.
Yeah. So just, and then just tell me a little bit more about the Amazon Original.
Louder Milk is about a guy who, he runs a 12-step program. And he's a dry drunk. He's been sober for 5 years, and he's young. He's like, you know, late 20s, early 30s, and he's just a bitter guy Wow.
That's my dog. That's why we're in the yurt, not the house. Wow, she's a rescue. Nice.
Must be fun around Halloween.
She's only like 5 pounds too.
But it's just, it's one of those things that kind of hard to describe in a one liner, but the character is fantastic because it's a very loving, kind-hearted character who's angry at the world, and there's a kind of
an opening.
There's a lot of, he has his ups and downs.
Is it a comedy?
It's a comedy.
Cool.
Yes, it is a comedy, but it's got a lot of dramatic elements to it. It's a little more real than other stuff we've done.
So is it going to be in the voting in the pilot season?
I don't know how that works. That's what people tell me.
I vote for the ones I like.
Yeah,
yeah. There was Mozart in the Jungle, which was cute. Like, it's more, we had another, it was just kind of cute, and I love the main
actor.
How
many did they make?
Probably 8.
And they have voting, and then...
Yeah. The viewers vote.
I don't like that, but anyway...
Transparent, I don't know if it got voted on.
Yeah.
They made the series, and it's very poignant.
Yeah, because you look at Transparent, like, would that really have been voted in? If
I don't think
Middle
so.
Middle America might not vote for that.
I don't think all of the pilots get voted on. I think, if you've got a green light to do the season, I'm sure. But what I love about, Amazon, Netflix, all of those is I am a complete, like, I will watch an entire season in a day. Like, that's kind of my version of a road trip.
Right.
Like, Orange is the New Black, the second season came out, and I swear to God, nobody heard from me. Gerard had to watch the kids. I was locked in the bedroom with, like, pots and pots of tea, watching it, laughing my ass off.
Yeah.
Like, it's great. And I really love it because, in a movie, you can have transformation.
Yeah.
But in a series,
it's nice because when the Gilligan's Island DVD came out, I watched the whole first year back to back to back. My kids were so mad at me. I just couldn't put it away.
That's great. Thank you, Pete.
Thank you. And, if I could touch on something that we talked about in the beginning, and this is, you talk about my New Year's resolutions. Well, this is mine. One of them is that, I am noticing, and there's an uptick in negativity online, and it is like in anything you go on, there's lists, and these lists are, they used to be positive and now they're negative.
Yeah.
It's like 10 most hated Wall Street guys, 10 most hated politicians,
it's
10 most
like they
hated
ran
actors,
out of good things to say.
Yeah, 10 most hated states, 10 dumbest states, 10,
where are you online?
You go on Yahoo. I mean, there's always these lists. Well, there's lists
really
of
careful.
Like the countries that Americans hate most, countries that hate America most, this is on and on. They're all over the place. And I found myself like curious. Oh, okay. Who are the 10 most hated actresses? Boom. I click it. And then I think, why am I doing this? This is just hate. Is hey, I don't
but
hate
the human,
them.
The human mind is curious.
I
so
know, but
if
but
it's
it's
sticky
it,
enough, you'll it'll lead you down there.
I know,
you don't
but it's
want
a, it's a base.
Negative.
It's a base.
It's
emotion,
hideous.
And they're playing off base emotions that people have. And my New Year's resolution is I'm not going to click on negativity online. I won't do it. I won't open up a negative story that's just negative to bash somebody.
Yeah.
And I hope that other people start doing not doing that because believe me when I tell you it's mushrooming. The amount of negativity out there online, is getting bigger and bigger and bigger.
Well, the more so there's a concept in Buddhism called imprints. And so every seed you plant, it can be a really tiny seed where you look at something online and get a little jolt of like, oh, well, she's beautiful and her life sucks. So I'm, oh, good. That type of. And it's a survivalist base part of the human brain.
Right.
But every time you have a little hit of pleasure from that, you plant a negative imprint, which creates a negative karma.
Absolutely.
And it just grows and grows and grows over time. So I think what you're saying is taking mindfulness and the positivity of the spirit and actually using that online and not having the split personality of like, okay, am I real life, I'm nice to people, but in my online life, I'm actually feasting off of negativity.
Yeah.
So I'll do that with you.
Yeah, 10 teammates who are hated by 10 football players who are hated by their teammates. Like, I don't want to know that. I don't want to go there. It's a negative thing, and I did do it, and I'm guilty of it, but I'm not doing it anymore.
Yeah.
And
you sound like you're confessing.
Yeah. Hopefully, if people don't do it, it will lose its steam, and there'll be nicer things.
And okay, so there's where our challenge to the listeners lies is they look at clicks, and then they feed you more of what you're clicking on.
Yeah.
So stop clicking on negativity.
Exactly.
Ban negativity online. Hashtag. All right. Well, you are a change maker.
Thank you very much for having me.
You're a good guy.
Happy New Year.
Yeah, Happy New Year. Give Melinda my love.
I will.
And I really appreciate your time.
Okay. Thanks, Sheena.